Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 211 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Amanda Mitchison speaks with John Siddique about her family's writing legacy, her eccentric newsroom roles in the Vatican and Cairo, the current plight of career journalists, and her wistful links to Scotland.
Today I've headed south, through the country lanes around Bristol, to meet journalist, children's author, and adult novelist, Amanda Mitchison. We meet in her beautiful busy kitchen overlooking her garden. The house is crammed with books. Even the kitchen has got bookshelves. We take our strong black coffee to her garage, which serves as an office. I'm keen to ask her about the many transformations of her writing life, from being a newsreader at the Vatican to being a journalist and a children's author. But first, I'm fascinated about what it must be like to come from a family of writers. Both Amanda's grandmother and mother were authors. So we begin by talking about the family business. So, Amanda, hello.
Hello there.
It's great to be here with you. And I wanted to ask you, really, I want to go right back to kind of, you know, your childhood, really, because you grew up in a house where your mum was a historian and a writer. Is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And was your grandma a writer as well?
My grandmother was a novelist who, at the time, was very famous and well known.
And who was she? What was her name?
Her name was Naomi Mitchison. You know, she was a friend of Aldous Huxley's. She was one of the first communists. She was a friend of the Webbs. They were very, very well connected. And growing up, you know, going to a little Presbyterian primary school in Edinburgh, and there was my grandmother, who was a sort of really a member of the gentry with a very sort of patrician voice, who'd go on television and talk about all the various lovers she'd had.
Really?
And I'd arrive at school the following morning and they'd say, "We saw your nan on the telly." And I think, oh, crumbs.
Wow.
And as a result, my own parents, my grandmother's children, have all been stoutly monogamous afterwards. But she came from that sort of, I think I'd say, a little sort of subset of the Bloomsbury group. I think she wrote altogether about 80 or 90 books. And she used to write them in the sitting room at home with people talking all around her.
And her style then, what was her style like?
Well, she wrote with enormous facility. She'd just sit down and rattle things out. And about one in four of her books, I'd say, was really good and was a ringer. And there'd be another three where she just burbled away.
Wow.
So writing was around. Yeah. There were other writers around. But it was slightly, in my family, considered a women's job.
I was going to say, because you've got your grandma, then there's your mum who was a historian.
Yeah, and she was a much more careful writer than my grandmother. My grandmother just spilled everything out.
Yeah.
And my mother chose every word. And I sometimes say to my students at the RLF, every single word in your essay has to count. Then I ask them, have you ever seen the House of Lords on television? And they give me that kind of blank, scared look when they don't know where I'm going. I say, well, if you watch the House of Lords on telly, there's always a load of nonagenarians sort of in the back row snoozing. You can't have words that are old, useless members of the House of Lords. Everybody's got to be working hard. And then they sort of nod in that kind of, she really is mad sort of way. And we continue. But I've much more taken how I write from my mother.
Yeah.
So I'm a much less productive writer than my grandmother. I'm scared of, and maybe this is a fault too, I'm scared of just letting everything hang out. But I don't write with my grandmother's facility at all.
So it's definitely down the kind of the female line of the family. What about on the male side then?
Well, they were all scientists. You know, they were, my father was a cell biologist and an enormous man. And he's sadly dead now, but his brothers are still alive. And one's an immunologist and the other did a lot of work with TB. But I remember one of my wicked cousins saying that there was think it was a third of a ton, owns up to the name of Professor Mitchison. They were huge, huge personalities. And sort
huge
of
people.
The conversation over the dining room table would always be about sort of T cells and whatnot. But I've never been remotely interested in that. I've gone to the Science Museum and I've just thought, I don't care how the combustion engine works. I'm not interested. So, yeah, lack of intellectual curiosity as regards cell change, mitosis. I have to let it go.
And were you a reader as a child?
Yes, we didn't have a television. Very sort of stoutly didn't have a television. Yeah. So it meant my aunt said we were fantastic kids to have round because you just put us in front of the television
and, you'd be mesmerised.
And we'd watch any garbage. Yeah. So I read a lot as a child. I was slow to learn to read. I wasn't a clever child, but once I started, I mean, I think I ploughed my way through Dickens and also a lot of things that now, I do think there is a whole category of sort of teenage fiction. It wasn't then called young adult fiction, but I read every book by Daphne du Maurier. Also read, very keen on Robert Graves. Read a lot. I mean, how much of it I took in, I don't know. But I do think that adolescence is a great time for reading. You can really get into books in a way. You'll never have that time again. You'll never be able to, you know, lie in the garden for 4 hours at a stretch and read every evening.
It kind of composts down into you, doesn't it? It becomes a kind of layer in your being in a way.
Yeah, I think so. Neither of my sons are readers and I feel it's a great loss, but they don't. But I think you're right, it composts down. It's there also. I mean, I'm amazed how poor the vocabulary of non-readers is. And that's, it's not that they're less clever. I mean, it's absolutely crazy that a lot of IQ tests are based on looking at your vocabulary. You know, what is a synonym for whatever it is? It's not a test of intelligence. It's a test of how much you've read.
Mm. So what was it that kind of struck the spark for you that took you towards writing? Were you writing when you were young?
Yes, I was. What happened was that by about 16 or 17, I sort of woke up and I, you know, began to, I think, be able to sort of cope with... I've always been very disorganised. I mean, we're sitting here in the garage and it is full of rubbish. You know, our house is terribly messy. I'm not naturally organised and I have a poor memory. And both those things, when you're young, count very against you at school. And there's a lot of very dreary, very clever sort of 8-year-old girls, you know, who can do everything perfectly. And I never could. So I was fairly underconfident. I had the most fantastic English teacher for A-level English. And that was just so exciting. He's dead now, sadly. And when I went back to the school, I discovered that he'd been a terrible fraud. You know, he hadn't had the qualifications he said he had. He'd sort of put up a great pretense. But his pretense had been splendid and we'd all been fooled. And, you know, we'd all gone off to study English at university very happily afterwards. But in terms of actually making my writing work for me, I think what then happened is I sort of left university sort of a bit buffeted, didn't know what to do. But I thought, I need experience, yeah? And I thought, well, I won't be a writer, I'll be a journalist, because a journalist is, that's a job. You can earn a living, and as we all know, earning a living from your pen is a really tough thing. Earning a living as a journalist certainly then was a lot more feasible than it is now. And I thought, well, I need some foreign languages. So I went abroad and I taught English in Italy. I found that I could learn languages, which I was pleasantly surprised by. So I then set about learning Arabic. I spent a year studying Arabic in Italy. Then I went to Egypt for a couple of years and I was absolutely flabbergasted when I arrived in Cairo and discovered, you know, I went into the bread shop and asked for bread. And of course, my Arabic was classical Arabic. They just guffawed at me. So I had to sort of learn Cairene Arabic. And I spent a couple of years there.
And you worked on a newspaper there?
Yeah, I worked on the world's worst newspaper. Actually.
The world's worst. Is that what it's called? The world's worst newspaper.
Well, no, it was called the Egyptian Gazette. I wrote some rather sort of precious bits of writing about my impressions of Cairo, etc. And the editor was clearly sick of this. What he really wanted was the editorials that said the people must cooperate with the government and eat less food. You know, it had the most fantastic health advice. For example, there was a diagram of a man with a huge blood clot on his huge black area of ink, as you were in the picture, on the back of his head. And then underneath it said, if you have a nosebleed, it could be a brain tumour. Terrible medical advice. Or that we had the same news story that would be recycled about every 3 or 4 months about the Qatara depression in the desert between Egypt and Libya. And on Thursday, we wrote Friday's paper, but we also wrote Saturday's paper because Friday was a holiday. And every day, blessed Hosni Mubarak made a visit to a governorate of Menufia and opened a semi-automatic bakery. That was their idea of mainline news. So, yeah. And also, because in Arabic you don't use the vowels when you write, and they had a shortage of E's in the press downstairs because they were laying it all on stone, they'd just take A's and turn them upside down to be E's. It was that bad.
And was it from there then you went, after that, they went to be a newsreader at the Vatican?
That's right, yes.
This has fascinated me ever since I read this detail. I've been thinking, I've been trying
how
to envisage what it is. Well, one, how did it happen? Two, what is Vatican news? Like, you know, today the Pope has used a purple towel? Or, you know, I have no idea what this could be.
Well, things have changed. But what happened at the time was that I came back from having spent 2 years in Egypt and I arrived in Rome and I was looking for a job. And I met this Irish guy who was working at the Vatican Radio, but he was a Catholic and he was working in one of the religious programmes. And he said, oh, they've got an opening on the Four Voices news programme. So I went along and I had a nice little pink blouse and a kind of long tweed skirt down to my calves and went in. And it was one of those job interviews where you've got the job before you arrive. You just come in and you just know because you think you're going to be answering questions about current affairs. Or no such thing. It was this very nice, rather clapped out Spanish priest who interviewed me. And the reason I got the job was nobody knew about the job. It wasn't advertised anywhere. And secondly, I had a nice northern Italian accent. There's great snobbery in Italy about what kind of accent you have. You had to be able to operate in Italian. The whole office worked in Italian. And I came in with my nice Bolognese accent and my little pink shirt. And then they gave me a voice test. And I told them about my completely fictitious year on Cairo Radio and they nodded nicely. Then they did the voice test and I have one of the last voices that should be on radio. I'm far too lispy. But they went, oh yes, that's fine. And I got the job. Nowadays, Vatican Radio is a much more serious operation. I'm sure you'd get properly interviewed, you'd probably get properly vetted. I wasn't vetted at all. I had a very limited shelf life there because when I went, they said, well, we're going to need your baptism certificate, obviously. And I'm not baptised, but I had told them that I was an Episcopalian, you know, Scottish Episcopalian, which to them at least was better than being a Protestant. You know, at least she's not a Presbyterian, is what my programme chief said to the bishop. And he sort of winced slightly. And so they were always waiting for this to arrive in the post and there'd be all sorts of different delays. Well, my mother's been looking for it, she hasn't found it, and then seems to have gone missing in the post. So I knew I was only going to have a limited life there because there was no way that if I fessed up later that I'd never been baptised, that they'd even want me in the building.
So at this time, was there any hint at all in you of kind of writing for children or for the non-fiction work that you do?
While I was in Italy, I did some proper journalism as opposed to just news reading. And I wrote about the wizards and black magic in Turin. And I wrote about poverty in Naples. And at that point, I wasn't writing any fiction. But I really worked at my prose. I mean, I remember when I wrote a piece about black magic. I remember I stayed up all night writing it, just getting the sentences absolutely perfect. I think I'd taken my mother's precept that every word had to count to an extreme. I was obsessively careful, and so I wrote pieces then. But in terms of writing fiction, no, I had a few attempts, but I just hadn't built up the confidence at writing at that point. I did a little bit, a few short stories. I remember sending off some terrible 1,000 words about looking at logs on the beach in Scotland to a literary magazine, which just sent me back going, not suitable for our lists, which at that time I didn't realise was a euphemism for go away. So I did a little bit, but not a huge amount. I was much more interested in how I could take the real world and make it sing. And I still think that non-fiction is an area with enormous possibilities. Really? I think the idea that fiction is creative and non-fiction is just reporting is so wrong. There are wonderful works of non-fiction these days.
Yeah. And do you feel yourself going towards that?
No, I feel I'm going more and more towards fiction.
Really?
Yeah. If you think about it, though, you know, I came back from living in Italy and I worked as a feature writer, writing long features, sort of 3,000 or 4,000 words, for the next 15 years.
Yeah, so that was New Society and then the Independent magazine.
Yeah, and then after that I worked for a beleaguered newspaper called the Sunday Correspondent, which you might not even have heard of. It only lived for about 9 months, and I worked there as what's called the fireman, which is the person who has their suitcase in the office and goes to whatever part of the world a horrible thing is happening in.
Really?
I did that, and then I went to the Sunday Telegraph, and I worked as a profile. I worked as an interviewer and profile writer when my children were young. But I have done lots and lots of non-fiction writing. And now I want to write fiction. But it doesn't mean that I don't realise just how much work non-fiction is. And to make non-fiction work, it can't be underestimated. The trouble with newspapers and even magazines where you get longer lead times is that you are working under conditions where it's very hard to produce your best stuff.
Just because of lack of time or...?
Well, lack of time and terrible editing by people who are under enormous strain. And, you know, you can write a piece that it's proper length. And I'm not being precious. I've been a hack long enough to know. You know, I remember writing a piece that was sort of 4,500 words, and it had to be 4,500 words, and it's cut to 3. And when something's cut like that, all your jokes go immediately. But also the rhythm of the sentences is changed, the thing is just destroyed. And really, for a newspaper where the editors are nowadays working under huge pressure, at The Guardian, for example, there's sort of a third of the staff there used to be. The Telegraph, everyone of my generation on the Sunday Telegraph is no longer working for the Sunday Telegraph. They've all been replaced by 18, 19-year-olds, including the editorial staff. So if you write, you get edited by teenagers, basically. They don't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And so it becomes demoralising, and it's terribly badly paid as well now.
Yeah.
If I work for one of the nationals, I'm paid 20% of what I used to be paid. Either you have to be a member of the staff, or you have to be a superstar. But if you are a kind of experienced feature writer, your job has kind of disappeared in a way.
Wow.
It's just, if you think about it, nobody buys newspapers now. They don't have the money to run a reasonable operation in terms of the quality of the writing. I'm always amazed how good the newspapers are, considering how poor their resources are.
So what was it then that's kind of taken you away from being in that world? Because you seem to be very much in that world for a long time. And then has started taking towards kind of children's fiction.
I always knew that what I really wanted to do, me personally, what I wanted to do was create my own worlds.
Yeah.
So that was at the back of my mind. I knew that was what ultimately I wanted to do, that what I was doing at the moment was earning a living and learning to write, because the only thing that excited me in the way of work was writing.
But where was you in all this? Where are you in all that?
Well, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the best way to write if you're a journalist is if you have a column. So I had a column at the Telegraph for a while, and then Dominic Lawson, who was the editor, gave my column to Harry Enfield. That was the end of it. But gradually, I just moved away from it. I just didn't want to do it anymore. And as I got paid increasingly less for what I did, I thought, there's no point. Let's just stop. And I stopped, and I wrote my first children's book. I won a sort of Arts Council grant for it, but my agent said, this book's never going to work, stop. I think it was all about a load of, they were sort of triffid-like creatures that lived in the cooling towers in Didcot cooling station. I never set out, incidentally, to be a children's writer. It's just that particular books that came to me were children's books, and so I wrote what came.
Because I was going to ask you about that. Do you choose your own projects, or have you put your own projects forward, or have these been suggestions to you from editors?
Well, the first published book I wrote, which was non-fiction, I wrote some children's non-fiction, and that was because an editor from the Telegraph had gone to work for a company called Short Books, and they commissioned me.
Is that the Dr. Livingstone
book? Yes. There were two. I've written two others, and those were commissioned, so I wrote those. They said, well, we need to do a Victorian. Here's your choice. And so those were the first children's books that I had published, but I was already writing a children's novel. I then wrote, I can't now remember the progress of it, but there was a period when all that was coming to me were children's books, because people would say, well, why do you do children's books? Why do you do adult books? And it wasn't that I set out to be a children's author. It was just a series of happenstance that arose. And then I wrote my dragon book. And then I wrote a follow-on book about trolls, you know, maintenance of trolls. And that was, the dragon book was partly based on the fact that my older son was obsessed with animals. So we had endless kind of guinea pigs and rabbits, and we even had a dog at one point. And all of those animals, you get these rather dreary children's guides as to how to look after them, how to clean out their, you know, their nests or whatever, you know, vitamins, how to look after them, how to train them. And I thought, well, why don't we do them for fictitious animals?
Absolutely.
And that's what I started with. And that idea of, you know, taking a format and then just exploding it, it was very enjoyable to write.
So last couple of things, and there's no getting away from this one. Scotland is there under the work.
Yes, I think all my books from now on are going to be set in Scotland, because I'm an expatriate here. You know, I don't sound it, but I am, and I'm wanting to go back. You know, mentally, I'm wanting to go back. I visit frequently. Members of my family are still there. I'd love to relocate, but I'm married to somebody who's very stoutly English. My children are English. They've even got Bristolian accents, you know. But I'm sure I have, it's sort of deep within me. I mean, I never left Scotland until I was 9. I remember the first trip to London, and, you know, I lived there till I was 18. But in ways, there's not a scratch of Scottishness left in me. Nobody would know. If you're talking to me, you wouldn't think I was Scottish. I don't sound it at all. But actually, that's what I want to write
And
about.
Is that then more of a kind of, is it like a spiritual connection to the landscape? Is it that aspect of it?
Or
is
it? I look at the landscape, and I'm trying to work out how to connect to it. So the book I'm writing at the moment is set in Ardnamurchan, which is a peninsula just north of Fort William. And I'm sure there is an element of trying to reconnect. The connection I had was always sort of warped by my background and by the fact that Edinburgh is so anglicised. My mother wasn't Scottish. I went to a sort of posh school and lost my Scottish accent when I was about 11. My sister rather sourly says that if you go back to Scotland without a Scottish accent, she said, I remember her saying, you know, people stop me in the pub and say, where's your Scottish accent? It's as if I've lost my virginity or something. You know, it's said in an accusatory tone. So in a way, I'm always sort of excusing my kind of English gloss, as it were, I suppose.
Mm. Yeah, and just to finish off, your next book will be an adult fiction book.
Yes, yes.
And so it's just really interesting, this kind of movement through your work, just kind of observing this line and just trying to understand how you're travelling along that line. It seems to be, even though it's kind of maybe not kind of clearly mm-hmm. conscious. And I just kind of wonder where you feel you're kind of going with this.
I think the book I'm writing at the moment is set up in Ardnamurchan, and it's set in a dystopian future. But I know that the next book I'm going to write is going to be a love story, and it's going to be set in 1745. I just know that. And gradually the bits of it are beginning to come together. I know I'm going to write that. So I can't see beyond the next book where yeah. I'll go, but I'm pretty convinced I'll stay in Scotland.
Yeah,
it's such a rich field. It's somewhere that I have a feel for, and as you say, that I have some emotional connection with, that I've got to sort of discover and work out and sort of struggle with.
Yeah, the feeling I get is more that the books are becoming more and more you in some way. From the days of, you know, being at the Vatican and the Egyptian yeah. Gazette and, yeah. and kind of that kind of miasmic sort of writing and kind of just writing whatever needs to be written.
Yeah.
While there's the imperative of telling the good story,
yeah.
there's more and more kind of something authentic and you in there coming through.
Yes, but also, you know, I was away for a long time, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose that's probably true. I would hope so. You know, if you can't get down to writing what you really want to write in middle age, well, absolutely. When will you?
Yeah. Let's leave it there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure.
That was Amanda Mitchison in conversation with John Siddiq. You can find out more about Amanda on her website at amandamitchison.com. And that concludes episode 211, which was recorded by John Siddiq and produced by Conor McPhee. Coming up in episode 212, in another installment of Location and the Writer, we visit a multicultural corner of London and an inadequately celebratory Birkenhead. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.